Hey everyone, so as promised, this is a retelling of my lecture from Herbstock 2017, which was Opiate Addiction, a Holistic Approach. Before we jump into this, I just want to say I hope you, if you live in the Boston area, join me at Herbstock 2018, where I will be discussing a lost history of sacred botanicals. All right, so without further ado, here it is. Okay, I'm from Massachusetts. Massachusetts has actually been hit particularly hard by the opioid crisis, with about 16% of all opiate-related deaths in the United States occurring here in 2016. Massachusetts opioid crisis has actually been so bad, in fact, that it's been chronicled in documentary films like Vanguard's Gateway to Heroin and HBO's Heroin, Cape Cod, USA, as well as Chasing Heroin. All three are excellent documentaries on this subject if you do care to look into it any further. But so, opioid drugs have caused five times as many deaths in Massachusetts as car crashes in 2016. Similarly, approximately 2,000 opiate deaths occurred in Massachusetts in 2016, with about 500 in nearby New Hampshire. In Massachusetts, over 80% of opiate deaths are caused by legally prescribed drugs within the past year, often from multiple prescribers. So that is to say that a doctor will prescribe you, say, Oxycontin, and then, you want more, obviously, to get high or whatever. So you'll go to a different doctor who will also prescribe you Oxycontin, thereby doubling your dosage. And unfortunately, in apparently 80% of opiate deaths, these pharmaceutical agents have been, related to the death itself. One out of every 12 people who died of opiates in Massachusetts had an active prescription within the last month of their life, some of whom, were still actively taking the prescription, while others had at that point migrated to street drugs. So regarding street drugs, obviously the most common street drug in the opiate family is heroin. Heroin obviously has its own inherent dangers, but the majority of the heroin-related deaths that you might see on the news, or you may very well know from your own friends and family and neighbors, coworkers, whatever the case is, a lot of those deaths are actually not caused by heroin itself. So just to give a little bit of a breakdown, if you knew the proper dosage of heroin, like in milligrams, you could probably just take heroin, and obviously you may become more addicted, raise your dose, and so on and so forth, but you can calculate the lethal dose of heroin. I mean, the information is available online, the LD50, which is the lethal dose for 50% of the population. This information is available to you. But what happens is, oftentimes heroin is cut with other substances, like fentanyl, which is 50 to 100 times more powerful than morphine, and carfentanil, which is approximately 10,000 times as powerful as morphine. And so basically what will happen is this heroin, which is, typically a white powder, is cut with these other white powders in such a way that you're unable to adequately determine the dose that you're taking of heroin versus the dose that you're taking of fentanyl. Like, you don't know what the ratio of heroin to fentanyl in any particular street blend might be. And so therefore, fentanyl, I mean, heroin can cause cardiac arrest in and of itself, but fentanyl is much more prone to cause cardiac arrest, and carfentanil could take down a fucking elephant. So essentially, the fact that these opiate drugs are illegal and are, part of a black market then leads to, these impurities, you not knowing what you're taking, and then therefore leading to deaths. And actually, fentanyl has found its way as of late into other street drugs as well, such as cocaine, which, some samples in New York City have been found to contain fentanyl. Carfentanil, its close relative, the one that's 10,000 times as powerful as morphine, is actually illegal in most of the industrialized world, except for the United States of America. And here it is literally sold as an elephant tranquilizer. I wasn't joking a moment ago. Because of their strength, they're responsible for many of the overdoses that occur, as they cause respiratory and central nervous system depression. So the most common treatment for opiate addiction here in the United States is rehab, rehabilitation, drug rehabilitation, as you may refer to it as. All of which is based on the Minnesota model, aka the abstinence model. So the Minnesota model was developed in the 1950s by two young men who had absolutely no prior experience in treating addiction, and it really hasn't been updated much at all ever since. As well, unlike cancer centers and, you know, other disease centers, rehab centers generally do not publish their success rates, which are believed to be about 5 to 10%. Or around the same probability as chance. It's also worth noting that many of these rehab facilities feature beautiful landscapes and luxury accommodations. These utopian settings are often aid in short-term recovery, but relapse occurs, you know, pretty much immediately after people leave, leading to feelings of failure on the part of the addict, and in many cases, embarrassment on the part of the family. But these feelings of shame are more or less unwarranted, and there's clinical research to support this point. You see, in the 1970s, a Canadian psychologist named Dr. Bruce Alexander conducted a study on lab rats. He gave two groups of rats free access to drugs, one of the groups living in basic rat cages and the other group given a what is essentially equates to a rat amusement park. The control group, with their basic cages, became addicted to the drug in precisely the way that we are led to believe addiction works. In fact, many previous studies had only had this control group, or let's call it what was Bruce Alexander's control group, where the rats are living in these, boring cages, essentially. But what Dr. Alexander found, what made his research new and unique, was that those rats that lived in this rat amusement park, on the other hand, with their choice between enjoyable activities and drugs, became addicted at a far lesser rate. With human addicts, we're pulling them from the comparative paradise of these rehab centers back to the boredom and access to destructive behavior patterns of their previous everyday life. In this way, it's fulfillment and meaning that are instrumental in recovery. But what I can say is for many, that fulfillment is not enough because it is a legitimate chemical addiction and dependency. So the more common conventional treatment is dosing with substitute opiates such as Suboxone and methadone. These chemicals, often in a form of sublingual strips, are safe in that they are not cut with fentanyl, street heroin is. They're given at clinics by doctors instead of in back alleys by dealers, but make no mistake, they're still very much opiates. The difference here is that they do not produce the euphoric effects caused by opiates, but still serve as an opioid receptor antagonist, thus staving off the withdrawal symptoms. A good friend of mine, let's just call him John, switched from heroin to Suboxone. And while the idea is to slowly wean the user off of the drug entirely, it's up to the addict's discretion of how much they need. So they could get a lower dosage one time and a higher dosage the next, which, John often did. Many people are on these substitute opiates for years and years. I mean, my friend's been on them since, at least 2009. This is not a curative treatment, but a substitute for the addiction of more dangerous opiates, with a slightly less dangerous opiate with which relapse is still relatively commonplace. On the other hand, there is hope in holistic healing modalities, such as plant medicines, nutrition, behavioral and lifestyle changes, and other healing modalities as well. But before you can understand how to treat opiate addiction, you have to understand addiction itself. So addiction to opiates largely stems from neurological changes associated with opioid abuse. As a result, much of the struggle of recovery is the struggling to overcome these brain changes. For instance, your opioid receptors trigger the release of dopamine, causing much of the drug's effects. But as the brain becomes used to this drug, it causes production of dopamine, your endogenous production of dopamine, to be lowered, your brain producing less dopamine on its own. As a result, more and more of the opiate drugs are required just to reach a baseline, normal level of dopamine production. When the drugs are not in the user's system, dopamine production then crashes, leading to many of the withdrawal symptoms that you may be familiar with, such as pain, anxiety, restlessness, sweating, vomiting, etc. This is also true with serotonin and endorphins, in addition to dopamine. Now, certainly there's, other than these neurological changes, which stem from overstimulation of your neuroreceptors, there's also psychological triggers for addiction. Oftentimes it is a form of self-medicating. So knowing all of this, there are some basic measures we can take, readily available without prescription, that can aid in short-term withdrawal symptoms as they help to bolster the production of these chemicals that are in such low quantities without continuation of opioid use. Hydration, electrolytes, vitamins, and minerals are crucial in immediate physical withdrawal symptoms, especially as vomiting and diarrhea are common occurrences, and these can deplete these various nutrients. But there's other chemical agents that we can take into account as well. D-L-phenylalanine is a precursor to L-DOPA, dopamine, and or epinephrine, as well as adrenaline. So that's something that's available over the counter, oftentimes in health food stores, may very well be available on like Amazon or something like that. Similarly, L-tyrosine is a biochemical precursor to L-DOPA, L-DOPA itself being a precursor to dopamine. So that's another thing that is available. You can get L-DOPA as well, which is a biochemical precursor to dopamine and an intermediary between tyrosine and dopamine. Additionally, GABA supplements are definitely available online and at your local health food store. That aids in pain modulation, which obviously opiate abuse is oftentimes associated with chronic pain, which led to the prescription for the opiate in the first place. There's also L-tryptophan, which is a biochemical precursor to serotonin, and 5-HTP, which is a precursor to serotonin and an intermediary between tryptophan and serotonin. All of these are available online, as is inositol, which is responsible for upregulation, or more common terminology, maybe resensitization, let's say, of serotonergic receptors. So it will make your serotonin receptors more capable of being sensitive to serotonin, again, as serotonin had previously been depleted by the widespread drug use. So outside of these, again, over-the-counter, let's say nutraceuticals, for lack of a better term offhand, some great treatments for opiate addiction come from traditional Chinese medicine, or TCM. China has used opium for millennia, and so they have a long-standing tradition of treating people who are addicted to opiates as well. In traditional Chinese medicine, they use ginseng to help fight the fatigue symptoms of opiate use. Reishi mushrooms are an adaptogen and a mood enhancer. Those can be used in the treatment as well. But there's other less common traditional Chinese medicines that are kind of more specifically geared towards opiate abuse. In a 2001 study published in the Journal of Psychoactive Drugs, subjects treated with one of these substances called Y-Nikom had a quicker rate of pain reduction, as well as less cravings and other classical withdrawal symptoms when compared to Suboxone, which again is the typical treatment here in America. They also required a much shorter treatment period, again with Suboxone. Some people are on that drug for many years, sometimes even longer than their initial opiate addiction itself. Similarly, in a 2009 study of 64 patients, Tai Kang Ning, which is a traditional Chinese medicine as well, was proven to be as effective at alleviating physical withdrawal symptoms as the antihypertensive prescription drug lofexidine, which is used for the treatment of acute physical withdrawal symptoms of opiates. And finally, another traditional Chinese medicine, Eufiner, is very interesting. In 2005, scientists did neuroimaging on the brains of addicts before and after administration of Eufenor, finding that it actually helped to repair some of the physiological damage to the brain, namely in the basal ganglia that were caused by heroin addiction. So Eufenor actually physically repairs the brain, whereas Winey Kam and Tai Kang Ning are, better at the short-term withdrawal treatments. Eufenor is good at, resolving the physiological trauma to the brain caused by the opiate addiction. Again, ginseng, great for fatigue. Reishi mushrooms, great as a mood enhancer and an adaptogen to assist in some of the other plants in being able to treat the opiate addiction. And then finally, Winey Kam, more effective than Suboxone at treating opiate addiction. But outside of these traditional Chinese medicines and the, again, nutraceutical elements that we had discussed earlier, there's other notable plant medicines as it relates to opiate addiction. So here's some of them. Some notable plant medicines for opiate addiction. Passion flower is a great one. In a double-blind placebo-based trial using clonidine, a standard treatment for opiate addiction, and passionflower, or in the control group they used clonidine alone, both were shown to affect physiological symptoms of opiate addiction. However, the mental symptoms were significantly diminished in the group that had passionflower in addition to the clonidine, whereas the physiological symptoms only were treated by clonidine. St. John's wort has a mechanism of action similar to selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors and has been proven effective in the treatment of depression and anxiety. This boost can help to bring your serotonergic levels back to a healthy baseline without major side effects or addictive properties that you'll find in many SSRIs. And so, therefore, that can be used in the withdrawal of opiates as well. So I guess next we have valerian root and kava kava. They're both very different substances, but they work in a similar way. They both help to reduce anxiety and depression that can coexist in people with opiate addiction. These plants are shown to enhance the levels of action of GABA and therefore can play a role in helping to control cravings and relapse as well. Next we have wild lettuce. Wild lettuce is very interesting because, kind of immediately after the opiate ban in the 1800s, wild lettuce was used by Chinese immigrants here in America as a substitute. It actually produces a milky latex, much like the opium poppy itself does. This lettuce opium, as some people refer to it as, does not have the addictive properties of, opium, but has a lot of the, how would I put this? It has like similar effects without having the addictive properties of opium. It's a natural painkiller. It's kind of like a non-addictive opiate substitute, again, with usage dating back to at least the 1800s. Next would be kratom. Kratom, as you very well may know, is being kind of investigated by the FDA. They're really attempting to crack down and make this substance illegal, probably because of how effective it is. It's a naturally occurring opioid that binds to the kappa and mu opioid receptors. While addictive and dangerous in its own right to some very minor degree, it's much less so than heroin and opiates. It's a stepping stone towards recovery for a lot of people. It's also instrumental in pain management for many of the people who would have otherwise been on, opioid pharmaceuticals in order to manage their pain. It can serve as a stimulant at lower doses and a central nervous system depressant at higher doses. The dose you would need to actually overdose on kratom is like ridiculously high. So again, it's not nearly as dangerous as actual opium or, opiates, heroin, and so forth. But, outside of those, which are kind of just good in the treatment of the, pain management side of things or the physiological symptoms, there's some much more profound treatments for opiate addiction that I'd like to discuss. So, what could possibly be more profound and more promising than treating the physiological symptoms better than the common Western medical treatment? obviously, if we're able to harness the power of these plant medicines that I've discussed previously in treating the physiological symptoms, again, we don't have, or as of yet, we haven't discussed something that will help to resolve the root cause of the opiate addiction. So that's where a class of plant medicines known as entheogens come into play. Despite what Jeff Sessions may say, legalization of marijuana does not lead to more people doing heroin. In fact, a study published in the journal Drug and Alcohol Dependence states that there is an inverse correlation between marijuana legalization and opioid-related deaths. That is to say, in states where medical marijuana is legal, opioid-related fatalities fell dramatically, with ER visits down 13% and hospitalization for dependency down 23% versus non-medical marijuana states. So that's definitely a substance worth pursuing, and that can help in the pain management side as well. Okay, so next we have Salvia divinorum. Salvia divinorum, also known as diviner's sage, has been shown to function as a kappa opioid antagonist. In stimulating the same receptor of the brain as opioids do, researchers are beginning to investigate its efficacy in the treatment of addiction. Many of you have heard of the psychedelic brew ayahuasca, which consists of DMT and a monoamine oxidase inhibitor. DMT functions on the same neurotransmitter as serotonin. So it can help in that regard, but it also is enlightening in its visionary elements, which make one reevaluate life choices and help to cope with things that may have led to addiction in the first place. Ibogaine works in a similar way, but also helps to reduce the physiological withdrawal symptoms of opiate addiction. Some studies suggest it does not cure addiction outright. However, more addicts were able to stave off heroin use before relapsing for a significantly longer period of time versus the conventional treatments. Keep in mind, too, that this is with just a handful of doses versus the long and continual treatment with drugs like Suboxone. So I guess next would be psilocybin. Psilocybin, much like DMT, works on the same neuroreceptors as serotonin, and so it therefore can, again, act on that same part of the brain to stimulate those receptors, as well as, again, much like ayahuasca, allowing for these enlightening visions to help cope with past traumas that may have resulted in the opiate addiction in the first place. But psychedelics, entheogens, are not really for everybody. In fact, John, who I mentioned earlier, his grip on reality is just slippery enough where I really would not want him, for instance, to use psychedelics just in the... for the potential, downside psychologically for somebody who isn't capable of handling them. So there's other treatments that can be used as well, such as mind-body therapies. So I just want to dive into some of those a little bit. Probably one of the more prominent mind-body therapies that people are familiar with is acupuncture. Acupuncture has been utilizing something called the NADA protocol, which has been shown to ease withdrawal symptoms for upwards of 30 years, actually closer to 40. It was developed in 1973 as acupuncture's main defense in treating addiction. More recently, it's been proven effective in clinical trials. And so NADA actually stands for the National Acupuncture Detoxification Association, and their treatment protocol focuses on various acupuncture points on the ear. I guess next would be yoga and meditation. These assist in relaxation. They boost serotonin levels over time. Clinical studies have proven them effective in the treatment of opiate addiction. Next would be EEG, or electroencephalographic feedback, which has been employed in the treatment of substance abuse for over 30 years. Hypnosis is another great one. My girlfriend's stepdad never had opiate addiction, but he had been smoking cigarettes for like 30 years, went to a hypnotist. They hypnotized him, and he hasn't smoked cigarettes again since, and that's been like 2 years. He cut you know, cut it out cold turkey. And, you know, there's also self-reported anecdotal evidence for opiate addiction being capable of being treated in the same way via hypnosis. People also find that guided visualization is great in the treatment of opiate addiction. Guided visualization is basically like a form of meditation focused on specific imagery and stuff like that. More religious people may be prone to prayer. Some people actually find that there's actually studies that prove that religion functions on the same part of the brain as drugs do. And so prayer can be useful for some people in that same regard. Other people, you know, Narcotics Anonymous would be great for people who are capable of getting help in that type of way. And also, obviously, therapy is extremely important, again, to treat the underlying early life events or traumas that may have catalyzed opiate addiction in the first place. So, I mean, that's pretty much it. That's definitely an abridged version of my lecture from last year. But I hope this has been informative for you. If you're struggling with opiate addiction, I would say definitely investigate these treatment protocols. Some of them, again, much like ibogaine, ayahuasca, psilocybin, those types are not inherently available here in the United States. Ibogaine is legal in Canada. It is legal in Mexico. And that is the most effective treatment that I have come across in my studies for opiate addiction. But some of these precursors to neurotransmitters such as serotonin and dopamine can be instrumental in people's success in overcoming opiate addiction. But I don't want to discount the lifestyle aspect of opiate addiction. So again, people going back to that much earlier in the program, the Rat Park thing, you really need to find things that provide you enjoyment in life and avoid people who are a bad influence and avoid situations that might make you prone to relapse. I think that is probably the most important thing. But again, dealing with the trauma is very important too. So that's where the entheogens come into play. So, I mean, all of these things collectively, I think could be, they could pretty much just be their own protocol as a treatment for opiate addiction. Now, definitely you want to research this yourself. Definitely want to consult with doctors, especially if you are on substitute opiate like clonidine or Suboxone at this moment. And obviously a doctor is not going to know what the fuck Eufinner is or probably even ayahuasca or anything like that. So you do want to look into it yourself, but I mean, the success rate of something like ibogaine is phenomenal. Kratom similarly, and that one you can actually still get. It's becoming more rare in the United States, but you can still get it here. That was actually used in Southeast Asia as more and more of the Southeast Asian countries began to make opiates illegal. People started taking up the use of kratom throughout the 20th century. So that, again, is great in the pain management side of things. So, yeah, thanks for watching. If you do have any questions or anything, definitely let me know. I'll be happy to answer anything I can in the comments section. And yeah, hope you enjoyed this. And if you happen to be in the Boston area, stop into Herbstock this year. I promise I won't ramble in such a incoherent way in that live event. And that will be focusing on the sacred history of botanical plants, much in line with the DMT A Lost History and Cannabis A Lost History documentaries. Thank you.